underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In a world where artificial intelligence is a reflection of humanity rather than a threat, where virtual reality will serve to connect humans, not to alienate and distance them, one daughter must navigate the unseen world in order to discover the truth about her father's hidden past. Liz Moore's new novel, The Unseen World, explores the complex bonds between a daughter and her father, spanning decades from the 1950s all the way to an imagined foreseeable future. Liz Moore is the author of the novels The Words of Every Song and the much acclaimed Heft. She is a winner of the 2014 Rome Prize in Literature, and it's a great pleasure to welcome her to The Book Show this week. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Joe. I really appreciate being here.
Very nice to have you on the program. What led you to this particular novel, to look at many of the subjects that I just mentioned in the introduction?
Well, the most obvious source of autobiographical inspiration is that my own father is a scientist, although he's a physicist, not a computer scientist. But that's sort of where the similarity ends in terms of my autobiography in the book. I wasn't actually a good science student, unlike the child prodigy character of Ada in the book. But I always wished that I were, and maybe the book was kind of my way of working out some insecurities in my past about my lack of talent in science.
Now, the father in this book has a secretive past, which I assume was not the case with your father, more so than
than most fathers have
with us as we were kids growing up.
Yes, he would definitely want me to clarify that. So, Dad, if you're listening, I'm including this disclaimer intentionally. It's
okay.
Not really based on you.
We'll clear that up right now. So when it comes to the idea of saying, okay, because there's the prodigy aspect as well. And is that something that fascinated you?
It really did, weirdly. I certainly wasn't a child prodigy, but as a kid, and maybe this is true of other kids as well, I always sort of felt drawn to stories about child prodigies. There were two movies in particular when I was a kid, and I think they came out in the early 90s. One was called Little Man Tate, and one is called Searching for Bobby Fischer, which is probably slightly better known. And I just loved those movies and watched them over and over again. I think it's empowering for kids to imagine that they could be as smart as adults, or that they could solve problems that adults couldn't solve. And so I was always drawn to those stories. And this is the first time that I've ever written about a child prodigy, but it was kind of gratifying to do it. It felt like it was scratching some itch that I had as a kid.
As I mentioned, this is very much about relationships and a father-daughter relationship, but also very much about the relationship between us and machines, which you certainly seem to explore in the novel.
Yeah, so the two main characters, of course, are this father and daughter, the father who has a mysterious past that his daughter has to uncover. And there's a third main character, which is a program called Elixir, which is loosely based on the ELIZA program, which was an early chatbot developed by Joseph Weizenbaum. And that character really becomes an integral part of the novel in ways that I can't really go into fully for fear of spoiling the book. But it was interesting to write a character that is a machine, because it made me really think about the humanity of machines, which is a trope that's been in frequently in literature, but it was the first time that I'd ever been exploring it for sure.
And when it comes to the research for something like this, I assume you read a lot about the past, and you also read a lot about the future. You would have to, I would assume.
I did, and I still do. I started some of the early inspiration for this book came out of reading outdated computer textbooks or, you know, programming guidebooks that I found in used bookstores in Philadelphia, where I live. And just looking at the ways in which computing has changed since then was really inspiring to me. I also read some classics like, you know, Douglas Hofstadter, and I read Andrew Hodges's biography of Alan Turing, which I found very inspiring. And then in terms of the future, you know, a famous, somewhat controversial figure in who talks a lot about futurism and computing is Ray Kurzweil. And I certainly read The Singularity is Near and, you know, all that stuff. I'm not sure how much I agree with his assessment of what's to come in the future, but it was really interesting to read and probably necessary to read if I was going to speculate about the future of machines and humans.
It seems like you do have a fascination, especially with Turing.
Yes.
What is it about his work and about the notions he put forth that you found so compelling?
So if my father was one inspiration for this book, my mother was another. She's a linguist by training, and she was always really fascinated with the idea of the Turing test, which in simple terms is the idea that machines will have achieved true intelligence when they're indistinguishable from humans over the course of a remote typed conversation. So when they can convincingly impersonate a human in writing, then what's the difference between machines and humans, in effect? So I remember her telling me that about that idea as a kid, and it really resonating with me, partly because I was using the Eliza chatbot program on the early computers that my father kept at home. And Eliza, for those who haven't heard of it, is a chatbot. It's an interface that was meant to mimic a psychologist and would sort of pick up on language that the user was including in his or her conversation to ask really broad questions. Like if you said, you know, my mother does this, then the chatbot might say, tell me more about your family, you know, the way that a psychotherapist might actually say. So that in combination with my early reading about the Turing test made me interested in Turing as a figure. And reading Hodges's biography of Turing made me aware of some of the movements in the history of computer science that brought me into to new places in my research, which eventually inspired the book.
So we first meet Ada Sibelius in the 1980s. And as I mentioned in the introduction, this book spans many decades, beginning with the 1950s. So why begin in the 80s with this 12-year-old girl?
Well, again, I was born in the early 80s. And so Ada's a little bit older than I am. Mm-hmm. But growing up, I grew up in the suburbs of Boston, and I have an aunt who lives in Dorchester, which is where the book is set. So my early memories of Dorchester in the 1980s, Boston in the 1980s, inspired the setting of the book. Although it's interesting, although I spent the first 18 years of my life in the Boston area, this is the first book I've ever written, or even short story I've ever written that was set there. So I don't know why it took me so long to write about a place that's sort of a childhood place for me. But once I started, it was really gratifying to revisit some places that were quite familiar to me as a kid, but that I haven't spent a lot of time in as an adult. I almost feel like for a lot of writers, the place where you grow up has a kind of magic about it that you have to be careful, you know, when and how to deploy. But for me, it was strange. It was like returning home to write this book.
So by starting in the 1980s, is that reflective of what was happening in science and artificial intelligence at that time?
Yeah, there were certainly really interesting things going on in computing at that time. Obviously, the first personal computers were widely available in the 80s. The dawn of the internet, you know, in some ways you can trace back to the 1980s with ARPANET. And there's a lot of, you know, I can recall my father spending a lot of time. We had a really early modem at home, for example, and I was sort of awakened to the possibility of communication between computers and between humans over computers in the 1980s using these really boxy, primitive gray objects. And maybe, yeah, I guess setting the beginning the book in the 1980s is reflective of my experience of computers in the 1980s.
Wiz Moore is our guest on the book show this week. The name of the novel, The Unseen World. It is published by Norton. I wouldn't classify necessarily this book as science fiction. Would you? And was that something that you wanted to stay away from?
No, I certainly didn't. I wouldn't say I wanted to stay away from science fiction. In fact, I was intimidated by writing what some people might consider maybe a hybrid between science fiction and realistic fiction or literary fiction, because there's such a long, impressive tradition of talent in science fiction. I think any community tends to be somewhat wary of interlopers or almost like amateurs, people who come to that community and say, well, now I'm going to do this for the first time because I have this experience as a writer of, you know, in a different genre. So I tried to tread carefully while I was writing it, being aware that there are many, many books that the science fiction community has written that deal with these themes. And in some ways, you know, the only thing new that I'm doing is writing about these themes that are often found in science fiction in a very highly character-driven way. So for me, the most interesting thing about the book is its characters, and that's true for me for any book that I write. Whereas, and I'm speaking in broad strokes here, maybe if this were purely a work of science fiction, I might be more interested in the plot and the ideas than the characters themselves.
And the novel is speculative, but it mm-hmm. is primarily set in the past.
That's right. Yeah, there are a couple of sections that move into the near future. And there I'm being pretty inventive and granting myself a lot of leeway in speculating about what's to come. But yeah, it is primarily set in the past. It's a remembrance, for one thing. Again, I can't quite, I don't want to spoil the book, but the book is very much about memory and about these characters remembering their past. So the tone of the book is maybe nostalgic more than anything else.
I do want to ask you this question, again, without giving anything away, but the ending may come as a surprise to many readers. And mm-hmm. is that something that you arrived at, or is that something that you had in your mind from the very beginning?
I arrived at it. I didn't have it in mind from the very beginning. I, unfortunately for me, work very slowly as a writer. I publish a book every 5 years about. And so that means that there's tons of false starts on any book that I write. And that includes this one. So when I began the book, it was a completely different novel. I would say the only grains of the novel that have remained entirely the same are the characters, the father and daughter of David and Ada. Other than that, the voice, the point of view has changed, the plot has changed, the profession of David is slightly different. I guess you could call it a surprise ending, or the ending itself didn't come until I would say halfway through what I consider the first complete draft. And at that point, I knew that I had to go back and tweak a lot, really change drastically a lot of the beginning of the book. But I also knew that that was correct for the book, and that I had to do it in order to write the best book that I could write. And so I sort of started over, and I'm happy that I did.
And yes, an ending, but also a resolution to resolve all of the threads that are out there in the course of the novel.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. That was my goal. it felt right to me. I guess that's all I can say, is it felt correct. And most of the time when I'm writing, I can feel if something is correct or incorrect as precisely as you might solve a math problem, strangely. And the vast majority of the time what I'm writing is incorrect, but every now and then it's correct. And that's why it takes me so long to write a book.
Have you ever had that where you had to go back and essentially rewrite to get to a conclusion?
Yes, every book that I've written, I've rewritten multiple times, totally from the beginning. And I have sometimes I usually keep a folder on the desktop of my computer for any book that I'm working on, where I save every document that I've even touched on the book, and those documents number in the hundreds, sometimes close to 1,000 by the end of a book. And that's scenes and drafts and, you know, timelines. And it's a lot of back and forth. It sort of feels like two steps forward, one step back, or two steps back most of the time.
This book seemed very different as I started reading it. And yet after reading Heft, there are many similarities too, aren't there? I mean, family is a big part, that idea of being an outsider and trying to fit in. There are a lot of themes that recur in this novel that certainly played a part in your previous work.
You're absolutely right. And in a way, I think that's the secret that every writer dreads having told somebody telling, because
sorry.
No. You're totally right. You found me out. I think no matter what we do, I'm lumping other writers in here with myself. I should just speak for myself. No matter what I do, I end up coming back to the same themes of, you know, being an outsider, searching for one's family, having a kind of broken family and searching for a new family. And the idea of being quite alone as a child or teenager. And it's funny, as I was writing The Unseen World, I would be banging my head into the wall, like just stuck on something. And then finally a solution would arrive, you know, like a gift. And I would think, thank God, it's fine. You know, it's here, I've done it. And then I would realize that is the exact same thing that happens in this other story that I've already written, or this other book that I've already written. And, you know, eventually you realize, no, it's not the exact same thing. This is a new setting. These are new characters. It's a different book. And so if a theme is coming up again, that's because that's who I am as a writer. You know,
sure.
What I'm interested in as a writer is family, almost more than anything else. And so all my books are in some way about family.
I would assume I'm not alone in having first come to your work through Heft. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about how you came to that story, keeping in mind what you just told us of the recurring themes and what you wanted to explore in that novel.
So Heft was, very briefly, the story of a morbidly obese recluse living in a big brownstone in Brooklyn that he's inherited from his parents, and the story of a high school baseball star, and their lives sort of intersect over the course of the book. There were, again, multiple sources of inspiration for that. That one is not nearly, there's no direct autobiographical connection between that book and me. My grandparents lived in Brooklyn when I was a kid, so Park Slope, I was living in Park Slope when I began to write that book. And my grandparents had lived there before me, my father. So, you know, the geography of it was autobiographical, but other than that, I guess I always say I was interested in our culture, which I think has a very distorted way of looking at food and eating. And I was interested in loneliness. And I would walk by these big, beautiful brownstones that often seemed to be uninhabited in Park Slope and imagine who was in them. And one day I imagined the main character of Arthur Opp, and I just sort of started writing his story. And the baseball player, came out of a lot of different things. But again, I guess remembering kids that I went to high school with and the various pressures faced by really gifted high school athletes who might have less than idyllic home lives.
And of course, there is the emotional ties, but also there's science in that novel as well, isn't there? I mean, in the sense of dealing with, in dealing with obesity and dealing with those issues.
Yes, sure. Yeah, you're right. You know, you had me scared for a second because I have to confess to feeling a little bit brain dead at the moment because I have a 7-week-old at home. So when you said there's science in Heft, every thought that went through my mind was like, oh my God, is there a chemistry scene? Like, What did I do? What did I put in Heft that I'm forgetting? There are certainly questions about what, you know, how to nourish ourselves. And Arthur, the main character, spends so much time thinking about food and eating, and it's a compulsion for him. So I guess you could say that there's a bit of psychology in it as well. He has, he has a compulsion to eat, and it really troubles him. That comes up a lot in the book.
Looking at the unseen world and thinking about writing, as I said, much of the novel takes place in the past, but you are writing a speculative book. Is it difficult to keep in mind and difficult to keep up with the changing technology, which is rampant?
Yes, that is a wonderful question, because that was one of the biggest challenges of the book, especially when it takes 5 years to write a book. I kept getting outpaced by things that I would, you know, my first versions of the near future have come to pass already. So Oculus Rift, the first widely available virtual reality headset, is now available at Best Buy in very limited quantities. I went and actually tried one out and they were completely out of stock. But that kind of thing is very challenging as a writer because we are naturally way slower than, you know, technology is. So I was cursing myself for having chosen that topic as I was writing it, because even stuff like I would start to get anxiety when I went to the movies and I would close my eyes through all the previews because I was so nervous that I would see a preview that was the exact premise of my book, for example. And even the stuff about touring is not a large part of the book, I would say, but his ideas inspire parts of it. And there was this weird cultural zeitgeist that happened in the middle of writing this book where the touring biopic came out. There were books about touring that came out. I couldn't, open my internet browser without seeing something about touring. And as recently as 2011, when I started The Unseen World, he really was not a household name. I mean, obviously he was quite well known in certain communities, but most of the time when I asked somebody if they'd heard of Alan Turing, the answer was no. And I think now that would be quite different. I think most people have probably heard of Alan Turing. I chose a really challenging topic to write about in that regard.
I certainly understand the concern there, but also the flip side to it is that people come with some understanding and allows you to further explore the subject.
You're absolutely right. Maybe there's a little less exposition that I need to do for each piece of technology that's in the book or for Turing himself, because people are at least, you know, tangentially aware of this kind of thing at this point.
The name of the novel is The Unseen World. It is published by Norton. Are you working on the next one? I know you have a 7-week-old, but are you working on the next one?
I tried my best to cram in as much writing as possible during my pregnancy, kind of like a stockpile. And so, yes, I started a 4th novel that I haven't opened since she was born, but I'm really working up to returning to it shortly, yeah.
Liz Moore's new novel is The Unseen World. It is published by Norton. Thank you very much for being with us, Liz. I appreciate you taking the time out.
Thank you, Joe. I really, really appreciate it.
A great pleasure. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.